today with Hobie Landreth. Good afternoon. And I'm interviewing you on behalf of Society for American Baseball Research. We're going to send a copy of this tape to the Cooperstown Hall of Fame, and then if any Sabre members have projects they're working on, they can access this information. Thank you for meeting with me today.
It's my pleasure.
I think probably the first thing I ask everyone is, can you recall the one moment in your life when you had a feeling that you might be able to play baseball at the major league level?
Well, I had a childhood that everyone would like to copy. When I was 15 years old, playing on the sandlots in Detroit, a scout for the Detroit Tigers approached me and asked if I would like to come down to Tiger Stadium at that time and catch batting practice while they were trying to get Hank Greenberg into shape. He had been in the military, had been released. The Tigers were on the road, and it was a 10-day to 14-day span that he was going to be working out, you know, hitting the balls, catching the balls, and whatever. And any 15-year-old, you know, being approached by a scout and asked to go down and do that would just leap at the opportunity. And of course, I did too. And this brought me into contact with members of the Detroit Tiger baseball team, because when they got back, they asked me if I would catch batting practice. And again, overwhelmed by the opportunity, and kind of rubbing shoulders by catching batting practice, and they let me take batting practice with them, it gave me an insight as to what it took to become a major league player. And it was at that time that I felt like, yes, if I worked hard and really honed my skills, I might have a chance to play in the major leagues.
And 5 years later, you were in the major leagues?
Correct.
Do you remember who pitched to you, and if you were able to hit the ball that first day?
The pitcher that a bunch of circumstances led to my being in the major leagues when I was 20 years old. I started the season of 1950 with the Tulsa Oilers in the Texas League, and in the first game, which is a story in itself, I slid in the home plate and broke my leg. And the parent team, the Cincinnati Reds, had my option canceled by the commissioner, and I was just going to travel with the big club and get in condition for the rest of that year, which I joined them in June. And then there was a game in Boston, or just prior to a game in Boston, the Reds were playing an exhibition game against the New Haven Sailors, and I caught part of that game. And there was three catchers on the ball club. One was Bob Sheffing, another was Dixie Howell, and a third one was John Permisa. And Dixie Howell and Bob Sheffing had injuries. Well, in the very first game in Boston, John Permisa seriously sprained his ankle, and they activated me and put me on the big club, and that's how I got to the major leagues.
Three catchers got hurt, and you got to the major leagues. And no one knows those guys' names. Did any of them ever do much?
Well, Bob Sheffing, he played in the major leagues for a long time and managed the Chicago Cubs at one time. But Dixie Howell played 5 or 6 years, and John Permisa probably played 3 or 4 years in the major leagues.
So what was the, how long was your minor league career?
Well, let me go back and finish your question. The very first pitch that was thrown to me was thrown by Vern Bickford. And that's when they had Sane and they had Spahn.
Right.
And
in fact, he's a trivia question.
Yes.
You say Spahn and Sane and Pray for Rain. Who was the other pitch? There were two other
pitchers. Vern Bickford and Bob.
Starts with a P or something.
Like Buell? No, he was later.
Anyway,
I can't recall.
That's
who
great.
But at any rate, he threw me a slider inside, and I hit a little Texas League out over shortstop, and I was watching the ball instead of where I was running, and I tripped over first base and just went sprawling. And the first baseman for the Braves at that time was named Earl Torgerson, who played service ball against my brother Charlie. And as I was scampering back to first base, Earl Torgerson was standing over me, and he was saying, "If Charlie could have only seen this."
So that could have been your, that was, you did get the hit. That was your first major league hit.
That was my first at bat and first major league hit.
And then, so, and then that year you only played in four games, but you got, you were 14 times, you got three hits and an RBI. Do you remember the RBI?
Was that 1950?
That's what it says here. Four games, 14 at bats, one run, three hits, one RBI.
Okay, two. I know we went from Boston to Brooklyn, and I played, I think, three games there. I'm not sure.
And then about, how about 51?
51, I played at Buffalo and was recalled by the Reds and played at the end of the season with the Reds. And, you know, I didn't play a lot.
What do you remember about Buffalo?
I remember that Spector Porsche was the manager, and Buffalo was a real trial for me because I hit the ball well, but I was not fortunate. I just kept hitting the ball at somebody. And later I found out that Spector Porsche turned in one of the best scouting reports on me to the parent team of anybody I ever played for. And it was just one of those things. Every time I'd hit the ball well, it would be right at someone. But, you know, I at the AAA level, you know, I advanced along pretty quickly and enjoyed it, and then was called up and played at the end of the season for the Reds.
What was that stadium in Buffalo?
It was it Offerman Stadium? I believe that's what it was, Offerman Stadium.
And how was it playing there? That pretty good turnout, fans were...
Buffalo's a good sports town. Yeah, they supported the team very well.
Did you play with anybody on that team in Buffalo that went on?
Yes. Played with Wally Post, played with Mo Savransky, a left-hand pitcher, Rudy Manarson, a pitcher, played with a fellow that, let's see, third, short, second, first, left field, center field. Perhaps they were the only ones that went up and played a year or more.
And then... So you played in, the manager was Luke Sewell?
Mm-hmm.
In 15 and 51?
He was the first manager I played for.
Yeah. And they finished sixth both years, 50 and 51, pretty similar records. How was it in Cincinnati, Crosley?
Well, it was exciting because, you know, as a 20-year-old, playing in the major leagues was exciting in itself. You know, as a child, I was always a American League rooter, you know, living in Detroit and rooting for the Tigers, and my exposure to the Tigers, as I indicated. But Luke, you know, I have very good recall of my experiences with him. And then after Luke, in 53, I believe I played for Roger Hornsby, and that in itself was quite an experience.
Now, didn't they say he was hard to play for?
Well, yes.
Wasn't he the one that got recalled?
Well,
the players refused to play for him or something?
Well, I don't recall that. Maybe that could be true, but all the newspaper people that traveled with the team, they would tell me that Hornsby really liked me. That Hornsby never showed that to me. I mean, he was barking at me almost constantly, always, you know, we were taking infield practice in Sarasota, Florida, and he hit a ball down to our first baseman, Ted Kluszewski, and Ted fumbled, bobbled the ball, and I was always a chatterbox, and, you know, even though I was young and inexperienced, I'd yell, "Come on, Ted, shake it up, let's go, come on, let's go," and Hornby says, "I like that, I'm going to make him your roommate." Which he did, and that caused me a lot of problems too, because he expected me to shake up Ted Kluszewski, who was an All-American tight end at University of Indiana, and a person that was an outstanding player, baseball player, but not a guy that you're going to shake up. You know, he had his mannerisms, and that was it. But you know, I remember one time I came down, Ted and I came down into the lobby from our room, you know, about 10 o'clock in the morning for breakfast following a night game, and Hornsby was sitting in the lobby, and he bellered all the way across the lobby. He said, "Oh, Toby," he always called me Toby. He said, "Toby, come here." And he went over, and he said, "I put you in that room to shake him up, not for him to make you a lazy guy like that." And I said, "Well, gosh, you know, we didn't get to bed till like 1:30 in the morning." But he was difficult. He was really difficult. Another time, and the players kept telling me, "You don't have to take that. You don't have to take that." Well, you know, I was just a young kid. You know, I'd take anything just to be in the major leagues. And one day in Chicago, he was hitting fungos to the pitchers running in the outfield. And we had a pitcher by the name of Bubba Church, and he hit a fly ball, and Bubba didn't, you know, run very fast after it, didn't show any hustle. And Hornsby said to me, he said, "Shake it up." He called him Blubber, not Bubba. He said, "Shake it up, Blubber." And then he looked at me, and I was just catching the balls as the pitchers were throwing them back. He said, "I want you to get on him. You shake him up." And after all these players have been telling me, "You don't have to take that. You don't have to take that." I said to Roger Hornsby, I said, "Mr. Hornsby," I said, "I don't know that that's my responsibility." Like that. I didn't play again for 6 weeks.
Just because you said that to
Yeah.
me. Well, who was the starting catcher? The starting catcher was Andy
Semenik.
Mm-hmm. Why didn't he ask him to do that?
I don't know. I was kind of his whipping boy.
Gosh, but it's so funny. Those first 3 years, they almost had the same exact record, 68 and 86. And I guess Hornsby didn't finish the year. Buster Mills.
Okay. Very nice guy.
They fired Rogers Hornsby, do you remember?
I don't recall that, but I'm sure they did if the records say that. That's been a long time ago.
Yeah. And what was it like rooming with Ted Kluszewski? He was the big guy who was the first guy he cut the arms on.
Right. Wonderful person. But not a person that is a rah-rah guy. I mean, he just got up there and he hit his 35 to 40 some home runs every year. Drove in anywhere from 80 to over 100, and he was the star player of the ball club, and I really, really liked him, and I enjoyed rooming with him. And I'll never forget one time, you know, Bertie Tebbets also managed the Reds, and I think I learned as much or more from him than any manager ever played for. And he taught me a lot about the psychology of catching, of, you know, when a pitcher is in trouble, he doesn't know what's causing him the problems. And he said, you know, he indicated, he said, you know, you can go out there, even if you don't know what the problem is, tell him something positive to think about, like lift your arm a little higher. It looks like you're dropping your arm and you might be overstriding. Tell him something to get his mind off of the negative of not being able to get the ball where he wants it and to concentrate on something else. So Kluszewski was in a slump. And he didn't know what the problem was, and I didn't know what the problem was. And we were in the room one night, and he was standing in front of the mirror, and he was in his stance. And I said, "Ted, you know, it looks to me like you're crouching a little more than you normally did. Why don't you try to stand up a little higher?" I didn't know if that was it. Or went out the next day to the Polo Grounds, and he started hitting ropes, you know, all over the place. He came out, and he had a smile on his face, you know. And he says, that was it, you know. So, you know, I learned a lot from Tebbets, and I really enjoyed rooming with Kluszewski.
The pitchers on that team, not really anybody that's, except maybe Clyde King, a name that I remember.
Mm-hmm.
What do you remember about some of those pitchers?
Kenny Raffensperger pitched in the major leagues for a long, long time. Left-hand pitcher. Not a fireball, but, you know, he just moved the ball around. He threw a forkball. And, you know, the very first game I caught in Boston, he pitched. And at that time, I could really throw well, but when I tried to lob it back to the pitcher, I wasn't very accurate. And he was one of the elder statesmen, and he was reaching here and reaching there and everywhere. And came in the dugout, and he says, "Kid," he says, "you're going to have me worn out in the third innings. Throw the ball, right." I said, "Well, I have to throw a little harder." "Throw it harder. I don't care." But he was upset that I was making him reach here, make him reach there for the ball. But he was a good pitcher. Didn't have a great record, but, a long-time major league pitcher.
And that year you hit your first major league home run.
Yeah.
Remember who that was?
That was in Wrigley Field, and it was against Bubba Church, a fellow that I mentioned earlier. And it was Wrigley Field. The left field foul line is 353 feet down the line. And I hit it down the line, and then there's a yellow marker that comes across to indicate anything over that that hits the foul screen would be a home run. Well, my ball hit just above that yellow line and just inside the foul pole. And I didn't know if it went out because it came back on the field. And I'm really chugging around the bases. And it wasn't until I got close to third base that the third base umpire was giving the signal that it was a home run. And of course, that's a big, big thrill.
And so you hit three that year.
Well, I only hit three, four, or five in my best years.
Right.
But I hit a lot of important home runs.
Tell me.
Well, when I was with the Mets, Warren Spahn was pitching. He was winning. Or the Braves were beating us, I believe. I'm not sure. They were winning by one run, and there was a runner on. Two out in the bottom of the ninth in the Polo Grounds. And the Mets, I don't think it was their first victory, but they didn't have very many victories. And this was, one of their second or third or fourth victories, somewhere in there. And I hit a ball in the upper deck. And in Polo Grounds, your dugouts are down by home plate, obviously. But the dressing rooms were in deep center field. And there was a big crowd there. I recall as I left this area, the home plate area, the dugout area, I was walking towards the dressing room between doubleheaders. I mean, the fans, you'd think Babe Ruth was there. They were just cheering like crazy. Then when I came back up, they just cheered until I got all the way to the dugout. And the next day, I'm in the outfield shagging balls during batting practice. And all of a sudden, I see this ball go flying right by me. And I turn around real quick. It's Warren Spahn. He's got a whole glove full of baseballs. He starts chasing me, throwing baseballs at me. Yeah. And then later, I was playing in a golf tournament in South San Francisco. And it was a Major League alumni tournament. And Spahn was there. And I had taken a new ball. I heard that he might be there. I took a new ball. And I was going to ask him to sign it. So knowing that a lot of the players had contract agreements where they couldn't sign anything round, I went up to him. I didn't take the ball with me. I left it in the car. And I went up to him, and I said, after saying hello and so forth, I said, "Spahn, I have a ball in the car. Would you mind signing it for me?" He said, "No, I'm not going to sign that ball for you." I'm very serious. And I said, "Well, I can understand that." He said, "Of course I'll sign it." He said, "I'll never forget that home run you hit off of me on the Polo Grounds."
Great. And what were your other famous home runs?
Oh, I hit a home run in, I believe, the 12th inning in Cincinnati against the then New York Giants, Leo DeRocher's club, off of Al Corwin, who, we won that ball game in the bottom of the 12th. I believe it was the 12th. And Wade Hoyt, who was the broadcaster for the Reds at that time, he shouted over and over and over again. People in Cincinnati never forget it. "Little Hobie did it. Little Hobie did it. Little Hobie did it." And that was quite a thrill.
So you played through Cincinnati for 6 years,
mm-hmm.
through 55.
Right. Then it was traded to Chicago, the Cubs.
Traded to Chicago, and I guess you were the starter?
Yes.
played in 111 games.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the most action you ever saw in your career.
That was not one of my better years, though.
Batted 221.
Yeah, and I didn't catch well there either. I don't know why.
Tell us about Chicago.
I like Chicago. I still like Chicago, and I like the Cubs. But for whatever reason, I just didn't play well, and I don't know. I don't know why. I went from there, 57, over to St. Louis, and had a, you know, for me, I had a very good year, both catching and hitting, and drove in a lot of important runs, not many, but Hal Smith and I alternated there. He caught against the left-handers, and I caught against the right-handers. But Chicago, we had a bad team. You know, my memories are good. I love playing with Ernie Banks. I liked our manager, Stan Hack. I liked our coaches, Pepper Martin and Dutch Leonard and so forth. But that wasn't a good year as far as my playing was concerned. St. Louis, I really enjoyed that. That was a great year. One of the things about my career is, moving around as much as I did, I was teammates with a lot of great, great players. You know,
I wonder how many Hall of Famers you played with or against. Probably a ton.
Well, I played with Ernie Banks. Let's see. Stan Musial. Red Chandies. Is he a Hall of Famer?
I think so.
Yeah. Alvin Dark, I don't think, is in the Hall of Fame.
Monty Irvin, I don't know if he
is. I played with Monty at Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Became very, very good friends with Monty. I played, of course, with the Giants, which, you know, those
McCovey
were
Mays.
Yeah, Mays, McCovey, Cepeda, Marichal. That was probably the best 3 years of my career. 57 with the Cardinals, 59, 60, 61 with the Giants.
So was it a lot tougher being the everyday catcher?
No. Actually, it's what I wanted to do. But, I always, you know, I was in the major leagues more because I was a good defensive catcher and being able to handle pitchers than my bat. You know, I always thought I was a good hitter, but I had warning track power. Getting the ball to the, you know, the outfielder would go back, everybody would get up,
But why do you think you were good at handling the pitchers?
Again, I think it was things I learned from Bertie Tebbets when I was at Cincinnati as to how to handle pitchers, when to get on them, when to not get on them, when, I was able to recognize when a pitcher was kind of losing his stuff or losing his temper or losing his composure and try to get him back on track. And sometimes I had to be, not the good guy. I had to say things that would get the pitcher riled up. And Alvin Dark, when I was with the Giants in 59, Jack Sanford, who had great, great stuff, later won 20-some ball games, had a great year. One day, Jocko Conlon was umpiring, and Jack was pitching well, but Jocko called a pitch differently than what he thought it should have been. And he just flew off the handle. He had, very temperamental. And Jocko, he was going to throw him out of the ballgame. And I said, Jocko, I said, let me take care of it. So I went out and I said, Jack, I said, there's 8 other guys out here on the field that want to win this ballgame. And we're not going to win as long as you're in the frame of mind that you're in right now. You either settle down or I'll have Alvin Dark come out here and take you out of the ballgame. You can't do that. And I said, Jack, settle down. You're pitching well, but you're not going to pitch well in that frame of mind. And he just kept it up. And I had a signal with Alvin Dark indicating to him when, in my opinion, he should come and get this pitcher. He not always did what I said, but when I indicated to him by a signal that I had, well, here come Alvin out of the ballgame. And Jack really was upset with me, obviously. And I lockered right next to him.
Wow.
And, but that turned him around. he then became a consistent, you know, he was rookie of the year when he pitched for the Phillies. And he had great stuff, but he couldn't control himself. But then, you know, every time Jack would get off track, Alvin would come and he said, I want you to catch him today. And, you know.
Now, did you call most of the pitches, or did on some of the teams, did they signal from the bench?
No, never. I never can recall a manager telling me to call a certain pitch from
Nowadays
the bench.
Nowadays they do it a lot.
I know they do.
Was there a rule back then that you couldn't argue balls and strikes with the ump?
No, no rule.
Now they throw you out if you say boo about the pitches.
You got to know your umpires, number one, and you've got to be careful of what you say and how frequently you say it. Mm-hmm. You know, and I remember Al Barley, first time I said something to him, he said, you do the catching, I'll do the umpiring, okay? You know, in a very stern way. And he was the best umpire in the National League. And I said, okay. So I knew right then, catch the ball, let him umpire. But not all umpires, not any other umpire in the major leagues that I was aware of, was as good as Al Barley. So, you know, there's other umpires that, and I would say things, and, you know, I argued with Jocko Conlon over a call at home plate, and I knew I was right. Didn't use any profanity or anything like that. You know, he called him safe, and I said, what? Real loud, and I had a shrill voice that you could hear all over the ballpark. And he threw me out real quick, real quick.
How many games did you get thrown out of?
Got thrown out of a game in spring training by Tom Haller's brother. And I was just sitting, I wasn't even in the game, I was just sitting on the sideline. And the guy next to me was on him over a call, and he came over and threw me out. Let's see, who else? I can't recall. There could have been a couple of others. But I can't specifically tell you where, when it was.
I heard Jocko Conlon and Leo Durocher had an ongoing.
That could be. Everybody had an ongoing with Leo Durocher.
Yeah.
But Jocko, especially in Chicago, which was his hometown, everybody swore that, and this couldn't be true, but everybody kept saying that, you know, he wanted to get the game over so he could go. Mm-hmm. You know, and it seems like he always had problems in Chicago. Jocko was a great owner.
Now, what about, we hear these rumors now about that there was a lot of sign stealing going on back then. Mm-hmm. Did you ever experience any of that? What, they were stealing them from you, or you guys were stealing them? Or?
Well, I go back to 1954 when the Giants won the pennant. And the Reds, who I was with, that was in 54, yeah. You know, we didn't win a game in the Polo Grounds. And, you know, they seemed to come back and beat us late in the ball game every game. Well, later, I found out they were stealing our signs from center field. Mm-hmm. And
that's what they claimed they did in 51 when Ralph Branca threw the pitch to Bobby Thompson.
I don't doubt that a bit.
Now, did you ever, during that period of time, ever see it, something that made you suspicious? Like did you ever see a guy hit and it looked like he knew it was coming?
Yes. And when that happened, we'd just knock him flat on his butt, not knowing where they were getting him. We knew that one time in Milwaukee they were getting signs from the bullpen, and they had binoculars out there, and then they would signal in to the batter, which was right in his focus as he was looking out over the pitcher. And Alvin Dark, after the ball game, Alvin Dark came in and said, anybody have any binoculars? And one of the players did, and we took him to the bullpen with us, and we were looking in, and he wanted us to get caught. Showed the league, you know, and he said, when it's an off-speed pitch, wave a big white towel. We waved the towel and hit. I'm not sure, probably shouldn't even say it if I'm not sure, but we hit a lot of home runs, and I don't know if that was the game that Mays hit four. I'm not sure. So let's say that it wasn't that game, it was another game, but we just cruised, and nobody said a word to us. We just kept signaling in, you know, what was coming, and nobody caught us.
Now, did you ever get the signs while you were hitting?
Yes.
And did it really help?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I got them more from my teammates that were on second base, like Alvin Dark, great sign stealer. And he'd look in at the catcher and he'd figure him out, and we had a pre-sign that if he looked away or if he took a step or if he closed a fist or any number of signs, that it was an off-speed pitch. And in fact, you mentioned Monty Irvin. When I was with the Cubs, I got the signs when I was on second base against someone. And I came in and I said, I got him. You know, if I get on, anybody want him? Monty says, you sure? And I said, yeah. And I gave him the sign, he hit a home run. But also there was a time in Chicago in Wrigley Field where we knew they were getting the signs from center field somewhere. And our teammate, Hank Sauer, he went in and got dressed and went out to the scoreboard, and he was going to really punish someone. Well, it turned out, I later found out that there was an exit in center field, still there. Have you heard this story?
Kuno Berrigan was the one who told me this story.
Is that right?
He's one of the guys who was sitting out there stealing. He said he stole it for the Cubs.
Yeah, well, they went on.
This was later, so this, yeah.
They went farther than that. This was in 59, I believe. They had a little electrical thing in the exit sign right above the hole that you go, the exit. And if it was a certain, like an off-speed pitch, they would have that thing go around in a circle. And the hitters are looking right out over that.
It's over the like the shoulder of the pitcher.
Yeah, right. And they see this little red light go on, and they know it's an off-speed pitch. Yeah. And many times when, and that's why they tried to really pull the reins in on that kind of activity. Back, remember Bob Buell and another pitcher for the Braves was caught out center field giving signs to the Braves hitters. And that's when they implemented the $10,000 fine to the club and the players participating in it. Yeah, but that didn't, you know, it just became more secretive.
Did you ever change your signs midway through the game?
Always. Always. Anytime someone had a real good cut at home plate, you know, and it indicated to you that this guy must know something, or he's guessing awfully well, you go out to pitcher and second baseman and shortstop and you know, change your signs.
Now, they talk about how important it is for the catcher as far as framing the ball. They say even if you line up off the plate, but if it goes where you put your mitt, a lot of times they'll give you the strike. Mm-hmm.
The term framing the ball didn't exist when I played. That came in later on. And I think it came in through the college ranks, the term. And what it is, as you catch the ball, you just kind of just turn it in. We did it, but we didn't call it framing. But there are certain umpires that if you were jerking the pitch, they'd tell you so much, you know, you keep jerking it, you won't get a strike.
Right.
You know, but by just catching it and bringing it in, just don't take it out of the strike zone, bring it in. Receive the ball, bring it in.
Now, who were the... what were your skills like as far as throwing out runners?
As far as what?
Throwing out runners, base stealers.
I had a good arm. I don't know what my percentage was. I broke my hand in 1960, and from that point on, my ball didn't have the real good rotation that, you know, the catchers like to have in order for the ball to take off. It was kind of going like this, and the throw was going into the runner a little bit. Then playing in Candlestick Park with the wind, that also would take your throw into the runner. So, you know, there was three flagpoles in center field, and I got to the point where, you know, I'd come up and make my throw aiming at the flagpole on the left, knowing that the wind would bring the ball back, you know, maybe this much. And I started throwing out runners again. But I could throw. That was one of my main strength was my arm strength.
Do you remember who, if any players stole on you a lot?
I can remember Maury Wills. You know, you know, he'd come up to the plate and I'd say, Maury, if you get on and you get on first base, I said, go, because I'm going to throw you out. You know, like that. And it was a real challenge to me. And all I'd tell the pitcher was, make sure he stops. If you stop him, I don't care the length of his lead, if you stop him, I've got a chance. And, you know, I got him a couple times.
So you would talk to the hitters a lot. Even if the ump told you not to talk, you'd always talk to
them. The ump could tell me to stop. I remember one game in Milwaukee one time. I played with Joe Adcock at Cincinnati and roomed with him one time at home. We had an apartment together. And he had come up to the plate, and I'd, you know, I'd be chattering to the pitcher. Pitch would come in, and I'd say, God, that looked like a pretty good pitch to the umpire. And then Adcock would say, you know, don't listen to him. He's from Louisiana. Don't listen to him. He's just trying to talk you into something. And we'd get into some serious dialogue at home plate sometimes. And, you know, I would talk to umpires, try not to yell at them, unless they were just ridiculous. But, you know, I talked to batters.
You remember any other famous conversations that you had with batters while they were hitting?
Oh, gosh. I can remember some incidents, you know, involving Pee Wee Reese and Jackie Robinson and things like that. I know Pee Wee Reese had never seen Sad Sam Jones pitch. We were with the Cubs, and Pee Wee was leading off the game, and Jones had the best curveball of any pitcher I've ever seen, and he threw this curveball, and it starts out behind the batter, and just keeps breaking, coming on. Well, Pee Wee's right-hand hitter, he got up there and called a curveball, and he went flying down on the, he went flat on his back, his hat came off, he's laying on the ground, and I never forget Larry Getz, who was the dean of the National League umpires, he went, "Stig!" like that, and Pee Wee's laying on the ground, he looks up at Getz, he says, "Larry, it couldn't have been." And Getz says, "Well, Pee Wee, one thing's for sure, you'll never know because you weren't here to find out."
How about Jackie Robinson?
Well, Robinson, I really admired the way he went about playing. I mean, he had the best reflexes of anybody I've ever seen. He could hit the low outside slider as well as anybody I've ever seen. He first came in the league, you know, he took a lot of things that a lot of players wouldn't have to take. I mean, there were a lot of pitchers that threw real tight on him and had a manager that instructed the pitcher to knock him down every time he came up, knock him down. Well, he got back up after being knocked down, and he didn't say a thing to the pitcher. He walked right, this is in Brooklyn, walked right over to our dugout, and the manager was Roger Hoynes, and walked right over, and he took the big end of the bat in his hand, and he pointed the small end of the bat at Hornsby. He said, "If I go down again, I'm coming over here after you," like that. And he turned around, and he came back to home plate.
What did Hornsby do?
Hornsby never said a word, and never asked a pitcher to knock him down again. And I admired Robinson for that. But I think the second game I played in the major leagues after coming from Boston to New York to play in Dodger Stadium, Jackie was on second. As I indicated, I could throw. And I saw him, I had picked a runner off in the game I played in Boston. And I felt pretty good, so I called a pitch out, fired it down to second base. Well, the throw was perfect, but the problem was that Jackie slid in the third. I never threw behind him again. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was a great player.
Did you ever talk to him very much one-on-one?
Not a lot. Not more than, "Hi, Jackie, how are you? Fine, Hobie, how are you?" He was always, you know, complete gentleman.
What was it like playing against those guys in Ibbets?
Oh, they were great. They were awesome. That's the best team I've ever seen.
They won at 55.
Yeah, and but I mean, they. When you look at Hodges and Gilliam and Reese and Robinson and Cox, Snyder, Ferrillo, and the left fielder Pafko and Campanella and Newcomb and Preacher Rowe. Carl Erskine, they were the class of the league. it was really fun playing against them, but we didn't win that much.
And I heard that fans were right on top of the players there.
Yeah, yeah.
They were real wild fans.
Right, they were wild. I was warming up a pitcher in the bullpen one time. It may or may not, it may have been 4th of July or just before or just after. And someone threw a firecracker, a cherry bomb, out of the upper deck, exploded right in front of me, and split my lip. I still have a scar right here where it split my lip. And fans were real rabid there, to say the least.
What was the, you played in the National League almost your entire career.
Right.
What were your favorite cities to visit?
I like New York. I like the New York is special, you know, because of the Dodgers, the Yankees, and the Giants. Yeah. And it was always fun going out. New Yorkers had a way of expressing themselves that was unique, and you know, they had several newspapers, and all of them were, you know, the write-ups. And baseball was big. It was big. And great restaurants and the shows. It was special. But I also liked to go to St. Louis. I liked Cincinnati. I love Cincinnati. Chicago, as I say, the city, I think, is one of the most beautiful big cities of any city I've ever been to, and I've traveled quite a bit, not just in the United States, but Europe as well. And then, of course, when the West Coast came in, how can you beat San Francisco? You know, it's just a great city.
So, when you were you were traded, what, 3 times?
Well, I was traded from the Reds to the Cubs for Hal
Jeffcoat.
Reds
to the Cubs for Hal Jeffcoat.
Yeah, I was traded from the Cardinals to the Giants for,
You were traded for Tom Pajolski, Jackie Cullum, Ray Catt, and Wally Lammers.
Yeah, but somehow...
With Jim Davis, Sam Jones, and Eddie Mitzis.
Right. And Bill White was also involved in that somehow. And then,
which Bill White? W-I-G-H-T or W-H-I-T?
The guy who was the president of the National League.
Oh.
First base.
Because you also played with the other Bill White.
Yes.
Who I interviewed.
Yes. Right.
He lives in Sacramento now.
You interviewed him?
Bill White.
Oh, my gosh. I'll tell you a story about Bill White.
Okay.
I was playing for the Cardinals, and White was with the Cardinals. And he had the best pickoff move of any pitcher that ever played. And... There's a man on first and second, first and second. Ed Bailey was on first, and Johnny Temple was on second. And Temple was stealing the base. Well, I knew I couldn't get him because I could see the jump that he got, but I saw Bailey going down, so instead of me throwing to third, I fire the ball to second. Well, Bill White's on the mound, and he's looking at third. Hit him right there, right in the neck area, just below his head. And he went down like a chicken. You know, when you wring a chicken's neck, his legs just like this. And I thought I'd kill the guy. I really did. And when he finally regained some sort of composure, he's still on the ground. He's not yelling, but he said, "Hobie, you didn't give me the sign. You didn't give me the sign." Well, there's no sign for that. You know, what he was referring to, when there's a man on first and third, you give him the cutoff sign. Well, that wasn't that situation, but I'll never forget that. Man, I hit him just as solid as could be.
And then, so you played 2 years with St. Louis, right?
Yes, yes.
And then you got traded in 61. Oh, no, 60. Oh, yes.
I got traded in 59, after the 59 58. Season.
Yeah,
or after,
right.
Yeah, after the 58 season.
They didn't wait long, right after the World Series ended.
Yeah, right after the 58 season.
To, and that's the, you were part of Ernie Broglio history,
right,
there.
Right.
That's how he went from the Giants to the
correct
Cardinals and later got traded for Lou Brock.
But Sam White and I came, or Sam Jones and I came to the Giants together. And there was players to be named later and so forth, but the washout of that whole thing was Bill White going to St. Louis and Ernie Broglio going to St. Louis. And I think Marv Grissom was also somewhere in there. But and then from the Giants, I went to the Mets in the draft, and it was the first New York Met. And I got, when I left the Mets to go to Baltimore, I was, again, in a transaction for Marvelous Marv Thornberry and cash. I don't know how all that washed out.
Yeah, you were sent by the New York Mets to the Orioles to complete an earlier deal that was made on May 9th. The New York Mets sent a player to be named later and cash to the Orioles for Marv Thornberry. So you've had some famous, some trivia questions for people you're traded for.
Well, I was far from being a star, but I really enjoyed my time in the major leagues and was very fortunate to have stayed for quite a while.
So when you got traded to the Giants, you were pretty happy.
Oh, yes. Well, no, actually I wasn't.
No?
No, I wasn't, because the Cardinals was going to take a trip to Japan, and I had already taken all my shots and everything. And turns out I didn't get to go to Japan. And I wanted to do that very, very much, but the happiest years and my best years were playing for the Giants. And then the Giants went to Japan, so I got to go anyway. Well, that's the best ball club I ever played on. And can you imagine a team that has four future Hall of Famers not being able to win the pennant? You know, and playing with Mays was...
Finished third that year.
Yeah, they fired Bill Rigney midway in the... Let's see.
In 60, probably.
60.
Yeah.
And then they replaced him with Tom Sheehan. Tom was a wonderful old gentleman, but certainly not a manager. But at any rate, you know, they have Mays and McCovey and Cepeda and Marichal, along with other real good players. I mean, we had Kirkland and Wagner and Davenport and Blasingame and Mike McCormick and
Brasood
and Antonelli and
Philippe Alou.
I mean, just a whole roster full of good players and didn't win the pennant.
Now, do you consider that your best year?
Yes.
You had a 251.
Right.
And it doesn't seem like you struck out very much.
No.
You had a low strikeout ratio.
Right.
And what was it like playing Candlestick, though? Because that was before it was all enclosed, right?
Right. It was blustery, windy, cold. It did everything but snow. And I played in, you know, early season games and cold weather towns when it was cold, but I had never been as cold as I was at Candlestick Park, and didn't matter how many clothes layers you put on, it was that damp air at night. And I remember Harvey Keene one time, I never saw a guy go out and play a ball game and had so many clothes on as he had on, and he had gloves, and he was still cold.
So the first year you played at Seal Stadium.
Yes.
That was before they opened.
Yeah, and that was fun. That was really fun. Small stadium, fans right on top of you. We had a good, you know, we had a real good team. Should have won the pennant. You know, everybody says they should have, could have. But in 59, with about, I think we had a series against the Dodgers, Milwaukee, and the Cubs. And at some point in there, I think we had a 2 or 3 game lead and ended up in third place.
And that pitching staff, Johnny Antonelli, Sam Jones, Mike McCormick, we talked about Jack Sanford, Stu Miller was the closer, Eddie Fisher.
Alan Worthington was also, wasn't he?
Al Worthington, correct. What do you remember about handling some of these guys or the way they pitched? I guess the best pitcher was... Sam Jones won 21 games, and then Johnny Antonelli won, it was 19 and 10.
Yeah. Well, it
was a good good
stuff. It was a challenge catching Sam Jones, and I caught him most of his games. He, you know, he had a great curveball. You could throw the ball hard, but he, you know, he was wild. And you had to be on your toes, ready to go all the time. But he, you know, I was traded from the Cubs to the Cardinals with him, and I was traded from the Cardinals to the Giants with him. So I caught him on three different ball clubs. Aunt Nellie was, you know, just a fine, crafty, good control pitcher. And Mike McCormick was coming along real well also. I think he won 11 games that year, didn't he?
12 and 16, yeah.
Yeah.
But the one thing I look at is all the complete games. I, you know, Johnny Angelini had 17, Sam Jones 16, and Stu Miller, supposedly the closer, only had 8 saves. That was totally different back then.
Mm-hmm.
Pitchers finish.
Yeah. Yeah, they did. Don't understand why it changed so dramatically.
Yeah.
Just like Marichal. Man, you look at Marichal's record. He pitched 53 shutouts. He and Spahn went 15 or 16 innings in a 1-0 game that Willie Mays had a home run.
Right, yeah.
I mean, can you imagine a manager letting a young pitcher, at that time he was still pretty young, go 16 innings? Boy, it's unheard of. I mean, they don't let young pitchers go into the eighth inning anymore.
Well, that manager for the Red Sox, he just
got
fired from the major league games.
Right, right.
Yeah, I mean, now the average guy goes 6 inning, gets into the 6, he's doing pretty good.
Called it quality start.
Yeah. And then Bob Schmidt.
He was, he and I...
You and he shared the duties the next year, in 60.
Yeah.
I've never heard of him. Did he play very long in the major?
Yeah, he played 4 or 5 years. In fact, he was on the all-rookie team in 58, I believe. But Bob was... a better hitter, knowing, you know, he was a good catcher, but he could hit the long ball. I don't know how many home runs he hit, but he was a good, he played well. I remember trying to recall. Lost my train of thought. Go ahead.
That's okay. Tell me about the stars on that team. Tell me about your relationship with McCovey and May. Who did you room with?
Davenport. And room with McCormick a little bit, but Davenport mostly. And that's another change. You know, players don't have roommates anymore.
Right.
Yeah, you know, they all have rooms by themselves.
Or curfew, seems like, anymore.
But the, you know, I had a good relationship with Mays. I'll never forget a time. There's a lot of Mays stories, but he'd like to come over. He'd test you, in my opinion. He would test you as far as your relationship with him by doing some, I thought, strange things. He'd come by, and players sit at their lockers facing the locker. And he'd come by every now and then, and he'd take his knuckle like that, boom, right on top of my head. And it hurt. And we called him Buck. And Buck, why do you do that? Don't do that. Don't you ever do that again. And I had tears run down my eyes, you know, eyes had water. And I said, if you ever do that to me again, I'm going to take a bat and hit you right across the shins with it. He did it again. I went and got a bat. Snuck over to his locker, and I whacked his shins with the small end of the bat, a handle. I whacked his shins as hard as I could hit him. He fell on the floor, and he was crying. Why did you do that? Why did you do that? I said, Buck, you ever hit me on top of the head again, I'm going to hit you with the bat again. Like that. Never hit me on top of the head. And we had a good relationship. I liked him a lot. I really, and still do. And, another time I had one of his clubs. He came and he says, I need a catcher's mitt. He called me Honest John. I don't know why. But he says, Honest John, he says, I need a catcher's mitt. Why don't you give me a catcher's mitt? And I said, well, I'll trade you one of my mitts for one of your clubs. Man, I said, that's the deal. You want one of mine, I want one of yours. So we made an exchange. And years later, playing in a golf tournament at the Olympic Club, and I knew he was going to be there, I took the glove that he had traded me. He had actually used it in the game. I took it down there and I said, Willie, I'd like to autograph this for my grandson, Colin. Man, he said, I want this. I want this glove. How did you get this glove? I said, well, you traded catcher's mitt. Oh, man, let me have this and I'll get you another one. I said, no, Buck, this is mine. I'd like for you to autograph it, which he did. But he wanted that mitt back. He knew it was worth some money, you know. And he was street smart when it came to making money.
Why do you think he's kind of gotten a rap for being somewhat unapproachable and hard to talk to?
Well, I'll tell you, I think that is the result of, in New York, and maybe even when he was in San Francisco, I'm not sure. But he, I won't say befriended, but was approachable. And he got burned a few times. And he is totally approachable by his teammates. And liked very, very much. And people that he has, non-players that he developed a good, solid relationship with, you know, he's the nicest guy you ever want to meet.
That seems really similar to what they're saying about Barry Bonds today. That yeah. If he's a teammate of yours, he'll stand by you 100%. But you know, you've been burned.
Well, Barry Bonds, Dusty Baker asked me to go to spring training 3 years in a row to work with the Giant catchers, and I had opportunity to be in the clubhouse with Barry Bonds, and Barry was unapproachable for the most part. And he walked around in the clubhouse, you know, you had an uncertain feeling about him that, man, you know, if you wanted an autograph, you were as a teammate, you know. Mm-hmm. I remember I wanted my son, who's a colonel in the Army, was in charge of a fundraising function. And he said, you think you could get me Barry Bonds' autograph? And I said, well, I'll try. And I went, you know, I had three balls and I wanted Barry to sign three of them. I wanted Kent and...
Oh, really?
No, who was the third one? But at any rate, I went to Bonds. He was standing next to Oral Hershiser. And I said, Barry, I said, could you sign these for me? They're for my son. And he turned around and started to walk away, not saying yes, no, or anything. And Oral said, Barry, come here and sign these balls, like that. And he came back and signed the balls. But
Oral's a great guy.
Yeah, but you know, Barry's a nice person, but I don't know if he had an inferiority complex about interchanging conversation with people, but for the most part in the clubhouse, he was, from my vantage point and observation of others, not very approachable. But, you know, I went to his father's funeral and he came up to me and shook my hand and said, Hobie, I really appreciate your being here. He said, it's really nice of you. And, you know, I don't know, but what a great, great hitter. Wow.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, just, you can't say any more than that. Just unbelievable. He gets, you know, his bat gets in that hitting area faster and with more zip than anybody I have ever seen.
What amazes me is these last couple of years is discipline. Because, yeah. I mean, if I were him, I'd be swinging at bad pitches.
Well, you know, this comes back to his being unapproachable. I think it's part of his total focus on doing what he has to do to perform the best. And part of that is what appears to be unapproachable in the clubhouse. I think he's so zoned in to what he has to do in conserving his energy, in being mentally prepared against that pitcher that day. I think all of that is a part of this. I don't know. It's just an observation on my part.
What about McCovey?
Well, people ask me, they often ask me, you know, what kind of a guy is Willie McCovey? And I say, well, if he walks in the room and smiles, everybody in that room smiles. And I was in the lineup in his first game. And Willie is, he's a marvelous guy, a real, real nice human being. And I was fortunate enough to be asked to be one of the guest speakers at the unveiling of the statue down there. And
you know, I saw you were quoted in some newspaper articles, the Mercury, a couple other places.
Well, I didn't know what to say, and I heard Peter McGowan make mention of his first game going 4-for-4 against Robin Roberts. And the night before I was to speak, I was real restless in bed. And my wife, she said, what's the matter? And I said, oh, I'm trying to figure out what I want to say tomorrow. And well, it turned out that, you know, what I said was, you know, let's go back to Phoenix, Arizona, 1959. You've all heard that McCovey went 4-for-4 against Robin Roberts. But I said, you know, have you thought about when Willie was told that he's coming to the big club, what kind of internal feelings he had? You know, certainly happy that he's going to the big leagues. Probably got on the phone and called his relatives and told them that he was going to the big leagues. And as he's packing his bags and putting his stuff in there, what kind of thoughts were going through his mind? Probably one of the first thoughts was, where am I going to play? Giants had Cepeda. He was rookie of the year before, having a good year. Why are they calling me up? And how am I going to interact once I get there? And how am I going to approach Willie Mays? How am I going to approach the manager, Bill Rigney? And how are my teammates going to react to me? You've got to know all those thoughts were going through his mind. And then he arrives in the clubhouse, and he is very solemn, you know, non-expressive. And everybody obviously had heard a lot about him. And they're kind of sizing him up. And obviously everybody's wishing him well. And then he finds out he's in the ballgame that day. And who's the pitcher? Robin Roberts. Now, as a player, even though he's in the minor leagues, and as a kid, he had to hear a lot about Robin Roberts. It's not just Robin Roberts. It's Robin Roberts, the Hall of Famer. Robin Roberts, who won more games than Juan Marichal did. You know, Robin Roberts, who had more accomplishments as a pitcher in strikeouts, shutouts. I mean, this was just a great, great pitcher. And this is the pitcher that Willie McCovey's going to face that day. Now, what kind of thoughts do you think he had about that? And then he goes up the first time and he gets a base hit. Obviously, everybody in the dugout is just delighted for him. Well, to end the day, getting 4-for-4 was unbelievable. And for him to come in the clubhouse and everybody press, everybody's all over him and sharing his excitement, I said, that was quite a day. And I kind of turned around and I looked at, and I told him what I told you earlier about people ask me what kind of guy he is, and when he smiles, everybody smiles. And I turned to Willie and I said, Willie, keep on smiling. Of course, by that point in time, I'm getting a little emotional too. And I have had more people express to me how touched they were and how they had tears, you know, coming down their eyes and or their cheeks. And I went to the opening of McCovey's restaurant, and he has some people that really befriended him and really treated him real, real well, that were successful in the soft clothing business. And I went up to, and they're, I'm sure, responsible for that restaurant being open. I went up to one of the brothers and I told him, I said, well, I appreciate very much being invited. And I said, I'll have to bring my grandson over here, who's a big baseball fan, and show him all this memorabilia. And the one brother, Rocky, he said, Hobie, you bring him over and he can have whatever he wants. You know, but McCovey is just a wonderful guy. As, you know, Marischal, just a wonderful person. That episode between he and John Roseboro was so out of character of Juan Marischal. But, you know, there were some things that preceded that that, you know, got under his skin a little bit. And there was never much love between the Dodgers and the Giants at that time. And
was it possible to throw the ball back and take a guy's ear?
That's what had happened. How did you know that?
That's what he said.
Who, Marischal?
Yeah, Marischal said that Roseboro was throwing.
Yeah. You interviewed Marischal?
No, I just read that somewhere.
Oh, well, that's what happened. The ball got away from him. Whether it was intentional or not, I don't know. But when he picked it up, he fired the ball back, and it ticked his ear. And he turned around and said, why do you do that? And then at that time, Marischal or Roseboro started getting out of the crouch. Now, whether or not he was lunging at Marischal, I don't know. But Marischal was standing there, and he had the bat on him. And when he saw him coming up at him, he just conked him on the head with it. And the rest is history.
I was going to ask you, did you ever get in any fights?
Mm-hmm.
Got one.
When I was with Cincinnati, Johnny Logan, there was something happened at second base. I don't recall what it was. And I ran out there, and then all of a sudden I got involved. And another one with the Giants, probably the biggest one I was involved in, playing the Pirates, and Don Hoke, who I had played with at Chicago. Very fiery, temperamental, good guy, but, you know, excitement creates strange things. He got into a skirmish with Darryl Spencer at third base. And I ran out there and I got a hold of Hoke. And, you know, after it was all over, my shin guards, buckles were, shin guards were turned around, my shirt tail was out. I didn't get hurt, and I don't think I hurt anybody, but I was right in the middle of that one. And then in Yankee Stadium, that's one of the, really, I was catching Robin Roberts, who I was a fraternity brother at Michigan State with Robin.
What fraternity?
ATO.
ATO.
And
my dad went to Michigan State.
Graduated. Really?
Yeah, he went there when Bubba Smith was there.
Really? Well, that was after me.
Right.
But at any rate, we were playing the Yankees in Yankee Stadium, and I didn't know that Robin Roberts and Roger Maris didn't see eye to eye. They didn't have good chemistry for whatever reason in spring training. Robin had been in spring training with the Yankees. So one of our players, Boot Powell, was hit right in the head by one of their pitchers, Bud Daly. They carried Boot Powell off the field on a stretcher. And then Maris came up, and Roberts never, my knowledge, never threw at anybody. Well, I'm sitting low and outside, and Roberts just undresses Maris. I mean, he goes flat on the ground. I didn't catch the ball because I'm low and outside. And Maris, being left-hand hitter, ball went right back to backstop. Well, Maris got up and he started going to the mound, and he had the bat on his shoulder like this. And again, Bertie Tebbets always instructed me that it was a catcher's job to protect his pitcher. So just prior to his reaching the dirt area of the pitcher's mound, I spun around in front of Maris and I put my hands on his chest and I said, hey, I think you've gone far enough, like that. Well, at this point in time, both dugouts were empty and skirmishes were breaking out all over the place. And next thing I know, Elston Howard has me around the neck like this, and he's yelling at me. He says, just because you ran the National League, don't think you're going to run the American League. And I said, Elston, I didn't run the National League. But police came out, and, we found out the next day. We went to Boston and found out the American League president or whoever fined a whole bunch of people. But that was, you know, never never big brawls, but skirmishes.
Right, which you know. Most baseball fights are, yeah. Pretty much. So then 61, with the Giants, you guys finished third. That's when you were, Alvin Dark was your manager.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so what happened with Cepeda? Then he just, they put him in the outfield, or? But he wasn't.
They first put McCovey in the outfield, and that wasn't going to work. And they put Cepeda out there, and that wasn't working very well either. So the Giants had to make a decision, and they traded Cepeda to St. Louis for a left-hand pitcher.
Ray Sadecki?
Yeah.
No. And then, so in 62, you find out on, I don't know the exact date, but you found out that you had been drafted, first player drafted by the Mets.
Right.
What was your reaction to that?
Well, Alvin Dark and Eddie Brasseau and I were playing golf at Los Altos Country Club, I believe it was. And Dick O'Connor, who was a writer for the Palo Alto Times, came out on the golf course. And he said, boy, you two guys, I went first with the Mets and Brasseau went first with Houston. And I don't know if he was first and I was second or whatever, but at any rate, you guys were selected first by both Houston and New York. And I said, oh, I didn't want to leave the Giants. And so, you know, first reaction was not good. And then when I got my contract from the Mets, it really wasn't good. You know, and
how much less was it than you expected?
George Weiss was, he was just, I mean, if you're the number one pick, you should at least get as much money as you made the year before, right? No. And
how much less? A third?
Not that much. It was probably $3,000 or $4,000 less. And I just told him, I said, you know, sent the contract back, and I find this totally unacceptable. I said, you know, you're asking me to increase my expense factor. You know, I lived here.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're asking me to go to New York where I'm going to have to rent an apartment, additional expense, be away from my family. I said, it's just unacceptable. And he sent me another one. I just sent it back. He sent me another one. I just sent it back.
Were they going up a
no,
little bit?
No.
Same contract.
And I said, I'll stay home before I accept these contracts. And I think I may have been the last guy to sign. I don't know.
Did he threaten to trade you to Kansas City? Or?
No, he didn't threaten. He just said that this is it. This is all we're going to pay you. No rationale whatsoever. I mean, cold. And I didn't enjoy that at all.
Well, he's notorious for the things he pulled at the Yankees. He used to tell them that their World Series share was part of their salary.
Yeah.
Stuff like that.
Yeah.
I guess he, you know, was just doing the same stuff with the Mets, pulling those same kind of things. So did you, with that expansion draft coming up, did you anticipate that you maybe were going to get picked? Had anybody said anything to you prior?
No. I'm sure there had to be publicly known who was available. I don't recall how.
Well, they just protected probably like,
They could protect, of the 40-man roster, they could protect 25 of them, I believe, something like that.
So you knew you were unprotected?
No, I didn't know.
No, you didn't know?
At least at this point, I don't recall having known that.
Right.
But somehow that had to be made public, right?
Right. Now, when you, why do you think they picked you first?
Roger Hornsby. He was one of their scouts. And the fact that, you know, all those writers had told me when I was at Cincinnati how much he liked me. I guess I reminded him a lot of Clint Courtney, and he liked Clint Courtney. Like scrap iron, I think they call it. But I don't know that to be a fact, if that's the reason, but it very well could be, because he was one of their consultants.
And you played in the Polo Grounds.
Yep.
And what was it like that first year?
Exciting.
Terrible team. You lost 120.
Very exciting, though. I mean, people rallied around that ball club, and just remember Howard Cosell coming up to me one time. Well, he interviewed me in spring training. He had a tape recorder, and he interviewed me and played it. And then he came up to me after we had lost, I don't know how many, but bad start. He said, I'd like you to go on my TV show tomorrow night or whenever. And I said, Howard, I don't think so. I think, I've already committed my time. He said, I'd heard how he really cut you up. And finally he says, he said, you know how to handle yourself. He said, don't worry about it. I said, no, Howard. I said, I don't need to go through that. He says, and then he asked me again, and finally I said, yeah, okay. So he comes on the air and says, and our guest today is Mets catcher Hobie Landeth. We'll be back with Hobie right after these commercials. Comes back. First question. Are the Mets really as bad as they look?
Went right after you.
Yeah.
He wasn't as famous then.
No. But he, and I, I've always been fairly good on my feet. I divert the question and ask him a question, and he could see that was going nowhere. But it was exciting being here.
Do you remember what the great quote that Casey said, why he drafted you?
It was, I don't know if I can quote it exactly, but it had to do with, if you don't have a good catcher, you're going to have a lot of pass balls. And when the press asked him why they drafted me first. But I had an unbelievably bad time catching in the Polo Grounds. In straightaway center field, they had a huge Chesterfield cigarette sign. Glossy green paint. Not flat paint. Glossy green paint. And as you're sitting down in your crouch watching the ball come in, came right out of that sign. And I had a few pass balls in New York. I don't know how many, but but then when I got traded to Baltimore.
You had three.
Three pass balls?
Canizero had 11.
Well, he probably had them because of that sign. It made you uncomfortable. You had to get yourself in a different position than your normal position to get that glare out of your eyes. But when I got traded, I was hitting pretty good. I was hitting 280-something or 290, I don't know. And had hit that home run off Spahn, had hit another one off Bunning in Detroit. That was a memorable home run for me also. You mentioned home runs. Was coming back to Detroit. Now, I lived in Detroit. A Tiger, since I was a kid, I was a Tiger fan. And got off the airplane and saw my wife very briefly. No. Actually spent the night with my brother. My wife was there. She was from California visiting. And saw